KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
On the ground in 1937.
As the leader of the free world, it is not in our interest to see borders changed by force. It's not in our interest to see free people subjugated.
Why the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine resigned in protest and what policies she wants to see changed. For Sunday, May 18th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Former President Joe Biden has been diagnosed with an aggressive form of cancer. We will hear the latest on the announcement. We'll also get an update on the explosion in Palm Springs, California.
This was a targeted attack against the IVF facility. Make no mistake, we are treating this, as I said yesterday, as an intentional act of terrorism.
And we'll check in on the WNBA's new season, just getting underway this weekend, plus Aminé's new album.
I think that Demons of Sunshine is more than just a new chapter. It's a hard pivot.
Those stories and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Reaction is flowing in to word that former President Biden has been diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer that's metastasized to his bones. President Trump says he and wife Melania are saddened to hear of the diagnosis, and they wish Biden a fast and successful recovery. Former Vice President and Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris says she and her husband Doug are sad to learn of the diagnosis and are keeping Biden and his family in their hearts and prayers. Biden's office says the cancer appears to be hormone sensitive, which allows for effective management. The 82-year-old and his family are considering their medical options. Republicans are hoping to get President Trump's big tax bill back on track with a rare Sunday committee meeting today. NPR's Luke Garrett reports last week five House Republicans joined Democrats in voting against the domestic policy bill.
Fiscal hawks on the House Budget Committee voted the bill down because of its price tag. South Carolina Congressman Ralph Norman called the bill smoke and mirrors. At issue is work requirements for Medicaid, the federal health care program for poor, elderly, and disabled Americans. House Speaker Mike Johnson said on Fox News Sunday that he largely agrees with the rebelling lawmakers.
Work requirements is a no-brainer. It's like a 90% issue on polling. Able-bodied adults who can work should work.
But this group of Republicans believes the bill doesn't go far enough. They want more cuts to Medicaid. Johnson said he is negotiating with them and that they'll fall in line.
We're going to deliver on this, and we'll get everybody in line to do it.
The House Budget Committee is meeting again late Sunday. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Israel's military says an extensive ground operation is underway throughout Gaza. This as ceasefire talks continue. NPR's Carrie Khan has more.
A Hamas official says the militant group is now negotiating without preconditions. Prime Minister Netanyahu's office says Israel is willing to talk terms for a permanent end to the war, not just a temporary ceasefire, as he has long demanded. The new movement in the talks comes as Israel's airstrikes pound Gaza, forcing residents like 43-year-old Fathia Nasser to flee. In a voice memo sent from northern Gaza, Nasser says before Israel would give some warning a strike was coming. But this time there was none, she says. Glass and rocks were flying after a close by strike, and she says she's lucky she survived. Carrie Khan, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Israel's prime minister's office says it will now allow a limited amount of food into Gaza after blocking all humanitarian aid for 11 weeks. Futures on Wall Street are lower tonight after Moody's Analytics Friday downgraded the United States rating by one notch to AA1, citing financial challenges tied to the federal government's growing budget deficits. This is the economy is already under pressure from President Trump's tariffs. Dow futures are down 0.5%. You're listening to NPR News. Commuters in New Jersey can once again ride the transit rails now that a tentative contract with the engineers has been reached. The agreement ends a strike that brought rail service to a halt on Friday. The union says the deal gives a better pay package than the previous one they rejected. It still has to be approved by the union and the state transit board. Engineers have gone 6 years without a raise. Scientists are learning more about what makes a cat, well, orange. Unlike tigers, the orange fur of cats is linked to their biological sex. And here's Emily Kwong has more on a scientific breakthrough in feline genetics.
After decades of searching, scientists have pinpointed the exact gene responsible for calico, tortoiseshell, and orange cats, like my orange tabby, Zuko. Scientists have long suspected that orange color was a sex-linked trait. Now, research teams in the United States and Japan have independently located and characterized the mutation responsible for the orange color. Study author Greg Barsh says the Stanford team partnered with cat lovers and community scientists to gather orange cat DNA samples.
It's an example, I think, of how scientists and the public can work together to not only uncover cool things, but also learn important aspects about biology.
Both teams recently published their results in the journal Current Biology. Emily Kwong, NPR News.
And U.S. futures contracts trading lower at this hour. Dow futures are down about 0.6%. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
KYC wishes a very happy birthday to KYC Kids Club members. Skyla, Stellan, Maxine, Hazel K, Minjay, Michaela, Buck, Ruby, Samuel, and Lorelai. Happy May birthday! Learn more at KYC.org. KYC Kids Club is sponsored by Alaska 529. One plan, many paths.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. Former President Joe Biden has been diagnosed with prostate cancer. The cancer has metastasized to the bone, representing what a statement from Biden's office framed as a more aggressive form of the disease. This announcement comes just 4 months after Biden left office. With more on this, we are joined by NPR reporter Luke Garrett. Hey, Luke.
Hey.
What do we know?
So last week, former President Biden went to the doctors and was evaluated for a small nodule found in his prostate. The 82-year-old had also been, quote, experiencing increasing urinary symptoms, end quote, according to a statement. It goes on to say that Biden was diagnosed with prostate cancer on Friday and that the cancer received a Gleason score of 9. This means it's a more aggressive case.
Mm-hmm.
The statement ends by saying that the cancer, quote, appears to be hormone sensitive, which allows for effective management, end quote, and that the Bidens are reviewing treatment options. Now, it's worth noting here that according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, prostate cancer is the second most common form of cancer and relatively treatable. But with this prostate cancer moving to President Biden's bones, this is certainly a serious diagnosis.
Yeah, and we should say this diagnosis comes at a moment when Biden's name has been in the news with a lot of recent scrutiny about his health when he was in the White House.
That's right. The cancer diagnosis comes just 2 days before the publishing of an expose book called Original Sin, written by journalists Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson. The book chronicles the term of the then oldest president in history and his deteriorating physical and mental condition. In the lead-up to the book, excerpts have exposed the efforts by those in the White House to shield Biden's age and increased slowness. And on top of the book, on Friday, Axios released the audio of Biden's 2023 interview with Robert K. Hur, the special counsel who investigated Biden's handling of classified documents. That audio showed Biden's fragile voice and his struggles to give dates and details. Now, those close to Biden have defended him and his presidency, despite the book and the audio. And it's also worth noting here, Scott, that NPR hasn't confirmed the book's reporting and also hasn't independently verified the authenticity of that audio. But both have reignited a debate about Biden's cognitive capacity in the latter part of his presidency.
And Luke, the last thing we should note is that Biden and his family do have a history with cancer, and it's a real personal one.
That's right. Biden's son, Beau, died after battling brain cancer. Beau died in 2015 when Joe Biden was the vice president to President Obama. And as vice president, Joe Biden led the Cancer Moonshot Program, a huge investment in research and technology to cut cancer deaths in half within 25 years. So that's been a personal issue for him as vice president, and he continued that as president as well.
NPR's Luke Garrett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, President Trump says he will hold phone calls with both Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Trump's goal, he says, is to bring about a ceasefire, something that Trump promised he would do the first day of his administration, but has struggled to put into action. Trump has been more critical of Putin lately, but by and large, he's sided more with Russia than Ukraine as he has pushed for an end to the three-year conflict. And that is one reason why the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Bridget Brink, recently stepped down. In a recent op-ed in the Detroit Free Press, Brink wrote, quote, "The policy since the beginning of the Trump administration has been to put pressure on the victim, Ukraine, rather than on the aggressor, Russia." Here to talk more about her decision, as well as what is at stake in tomorrow's talks, is former Ambassador Bridget Brink. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
I think it's important to say you are a career diplomat. You were President Biden's ambassador to Ukraine, but it's worth pointing out you were nominated for a different post by President Trump during his first term. What pushed you to resign?
Well, for 3 years, I was there as Russia launched missiles and drones that killed men, women, and children in their homes, on playgrounds, in churches. For 3 years, Russia tried to take down the energy grid in Ukraine, to take the power, heat, and light out for millions of people in the dead of Ukrainian winter. And also, Russia committed atrocities and war crimes at a level that we have not seen in Europe since World War II. So in that context, as the administration began, the policy was to put pressure on Ukraine, the victim, rather than on Russia, the aggressor. And for this reason, I felt I couldn't execute the president's policy in good faith, and I had to step down.
You stepped down in April. Was there a specific moment that pushed you over the edge?
Yes. There were many moments, some I can talk about, some I can't. But the first moment was the Oval Office meeting, which was horrifying.
Right. This is when President Trump and Vice President Vance essentially berated Zelensky in the Oval Office.
In February. So it was a number of different reasons, but starting with the Oval Office meeting.
In public, in the last few weeks at least, President Trump seems to have been more critical of President Putin. What do you make of that shift? Do you put any stock in it? Do you think that is a meaningful shift?
My view is that what we need to do to achieve the objectives of the administration, which is to end the war, is to end it in a way that also is good for the United States. And that requires us putting more pressure on Putin, active pressure. So first, it requires more sanctions in the energy sector, in the banking sector, together with partners and allies. Second, I think we shouldn't give any concession to Putin, not a meeting, not any legitimacy, not anything, until he actually agrees to an unconditional, verifiable ceasefire. And third, we should get the $300 billion that are in Europe that are Russian sovereign assets, and we should use those to enable Ukraine to defend itself.
That's largely continuing a lot of the policies of the Biden administration. Were those policies working? This war was in its third year, and the battle lines have essentially been frozen into place for a very long period of time now.
I think it's quite remarkable that Ukraine has been able to hold its position in the context of Russia launching a full assault on the country in every possible way. Just last night, for example, Russia sent 300 drones to Ukraine. That's the largest number that has been sent since the start of the war. And I think it indicates that Putin is not at all interested in peace.
I understand that, but I guess I'm trying to get a sense of, do you think there is, can you give me more details on a realistic path that does more than drag out the continued conflict in a stalemate kind of way until those negotiations begin?
I think we have to put more pressure on Russia and do it
together. Is that military pressure?
It's every kind of pressure, starting with sanctions. More pressure on the energy side, more pressure on the banking side. Interest rates in Russia are at 21%. Inflation's at 10%. Russia's economy is really hurting, and Putin's looking for ways to relieve that pressure. And that's why he's dragging out this process and dragging out this war. If he were as strong as what I think he wants to portray, he would have been successful a long time ago. So Russia's much weaker than people think, and Ukraine is much stronger.
You're saying Russia's economy is damaged, and it's definitely true. But Russia did not seem to change its approach in any way after years and years of those tough sanctions from the Biden administration.
I believe the sanctions are working, and I think that's why the Russian economy is having trouble right now. I think they need to continue. They can be increased. We can do more in support of Ukraine's ability to defend itself, but not just us. I think also having Europeans step up and do more at NATO, contribute more, and also in the context of how to secure a peace. Mm-hmm. But to do it collectively is very important. I think our role is absolutely critical and key.
Can I ask what you personally thought of the minerals deal that has been central to the conversation the last few months? The Trump administration putting a lot of pressure in Ukraine to essentially sign away rights to much of the minerals under its ground. I've heard this criticized as you know, effective colonization type policy. I have heard it also people say, look, the United States has spent billions and billions and billions of dollars on this country. It's not wrong to try to want something out of it. Where did you personally stand on this agreement and the pressure that the U.S. Put on it being signed?
I think the negotiated agreement is a positive thing, and it does give us an economic link and partnership with Ukraine. I think important to this agreement is going to be also security for the U.S. businesses that potentially would invest in Ukraine. And so again, ending the war in a way that gives Ukraine security and is a just and durable peace is deeply important to the United States.
You've said that several times, and I think you've seen the public opinion polls. I think there's a lot of people in this country who either don't care about what is happening in Ukraine or they care about it, but it's not top of mind compared to other issues. Since you have come back to this point so many times, I'd love to ask you to make the case of why what happens in Ukraine matters to the U.S. and why the United States government's stance on what happens to Ukraine matters to Americans.
Sure. I mean, there are policy reasons, foreign policy reasons. Number one, if Putin is successful in his effort to subjugate and take a country of 40 million people in Europe, I think his ambition is much wider. He wants to recreate an imperial past. He also wants to weaken and divide Europe and the United States. In addition to that, there's the signal that any action, if Putin is successful, what signal that sends to China and its actions in Asia and other aggressors around the world. As the leader of the free world, it is not in our interest to see borders changed by force. It is not in our interest to see democracies undermined and bombarded. It's not in our interest to see free people subjugated.
That is Bridget Brink, now the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
KUAC is a lifeline for interior Alaska, but it could vanish. One decision could end public media as we know it and silence our local service. Act now. Contact Congress at protectmypublicmedia.org.
If you enjoy the kind of news you're getting this afternoon, well, if you enjoy knowing the things that we bring you, that is the place to go and the thing to do. KUAC is supported by the Great Alaskan Bull Company, featuring Father's Day gifts of all sorts. Gift wrapping and shipping is available 7 days a week at 4630 Old Airport Way and at woodbull.com. The Contra Borealis Dancers invites the public to old-time music workshops and a concert with Reese Jones on Sunday. That's tonight.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Former President Biden has been diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer, which has metastasized to his bones. A statement from his personal office says the cancer appears to be hormone-sensitive, which allows for effective management, and that he and his family are evaluating their options.
Israel says it's launched extensive ground operations in Gaza to pressure Hamas into releasing the remaining live hostages as the two sides continue to negotiate a ceasefire. This after extensive airstrikes in Gaza over the past week that killed hundreds of Palestinians. Meanwhile, Israel's prime minister's office now says it will allow in some food deliveries into Gaza after blocking humanitarian aid for 11 weeks. And at the weekend box office, Final Destination Bloodlines took the top spot with an estimated $15 million. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the University at Buffalo, the University at Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. A car bomb explosion yesterday at a fertility clinic in Palm Springs, California, east of Los Angeles, has left one person dead and at least four others wounded. Law enforcement is calling it an act of terrorism. NPR's Jason DeRose joins me now from Palm Springs. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
What do we know about what's happened?
Well, at about 11 o'clock local time Saturday in the morning, a major blast shook a neighborhood here in downtown Palm Springs. The explosion happened in the parking lot of American Reproductive Center's office, a place that does in vitro fertilization or IVF. It's a single-story stucco building with ceramic tile roof, now badly damaged, almost collapsed, really. It's right across the street from the hospital here. Windows for blocks around were blown out. People all over town could hear the explosion. Authorities said this was a powerful bomb, and debris is strewn across a five-lane road where the office is located, and pieces of the car landed blocks away. Now, the head of the fertility clinic posted on social media that nobody from his office was injured, and the Palm Springs police chief says all the embryos there were saved due to the work of the fire department.
What are authorities saying at this point about the explosion and who's responsible?
Well, the FBI reiterated today that this is an intentional act of terrorism. They say the Joint Terrorism Task Force is investigating. Assistant FBI Los Angeles Director Akil Davis named the primary suspect in the case. He said they are fairly confident it is Guy Edward Bartkus, 25 years old, from the city of 29 Palms here in California. Here's what Assistant Director Davis said.
The subject had nihilistic ideations, and this was a targeted attack against the IDF facility. Make no mistake, we are treating this, as I said yesterday, as an intentional act of terrorism.
Davis says that evaluation is based on the FBI investigation into some of the posts that Bartkus is believed to have made online, which authorities are combing through now. Davis says the suspect may have tried to live stream the attack online, and he says Bartkus is likely the one person who was killed in the attack. The U.S. Attorney's Office in the region says investigators are working to positively identify those remains. Now, of the four people who were wounded, authorities say they've been treated and have been released.
You mentioned that wide blast radius. What is the scene like today?
Well, as far as the town itself goes, you know, this is a resort town 2 hours east of Los Angeles. People come here to get away from the hustle and bustle of LA and spend the weekend. And today, as I was walking around, the explosion is the talk of the town. People are rattled. Roads all over town are blocked off. Police barricades are in place because authorities say, again, the blast sent debris over a multi-block area, and investigators are searching for evidence on the streets, in people's backyards, front yards, parking lots, all over the area. A large swath near downtown Palm Springs. There are also multiple canine units with dogs sniffing for evidence as well, but some streets are just now beginning to reopen.
You said before that the suspect, according to the FBI, is from 29 Palms. What's going on there?
Well, authorities say there is a second investigation site in that city. That's about an hour away, northeast of here, on the other side of Joshua Tree National Park. Large areas, neighborhoods there, have been blocked off and evacuated because of a fear of additional explosive material. The idea being that the suspect may have lived in the area. The FBI is investigating, and legal records suggest that a property in 29 Palms may belong to the suspect's mother.
That is NPR's Jason DeRose in Palm Springs, California. California. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Portland rapper Amine has a new album out. It's called 13 Months of Sunshine. We spoke about the album with music journalist Akenna Ofor. He says it shows Amine's maturity as an artist, drawing on his upbringing and his roots to create a sound that's confident and unique. We asked him to tell us about a few standout songs.
You've grown yourself a flower.
So New Flower, that opened the album on a wistful, lightly psychedelic, hazy note. Sort of like, if you think early Toro y Moi with like a bit of West Coast sunshine injected into it. Fantastic song.
I don't believe in a sure thing, but now we do because my wrist like the West Wing. I had to go my own garden, plan deceased, but I was faint hearted. The courage it took to get started.
The verse is subdued, but emotionally acute. So like he says, he reminisces back on when he was broke and didn't have anything. And in the rest of the song, it unfolds like someone slowly unpacking a memory box.
In the garden.
He says that his grandfather was like a horticulturist. And so after school, that was like his sort of hobby to stay out of trouble.
Maintaining it, giving it water, stuff like that. This is how I grew up.
He used to help his grandfather in the garden. So with New Flower, it's like he's calling back to those memories, but also presenting himself as like, I came from that. These are the memories that shaped me as a, like, as a person, and this is the man I've become right now.
I'm depressed. If people don't like me, then I don't get a check, which means both my parents are staying in debt, and I prefer to be the only one that carries the stress. If I never got rich, maybe Sunset wouldn't have me sick, because that crash almost toe-tagged my sister. Is it my fault that she even had that risk? But what I can't control, the best advice I get from my...
For me, history is Amine in diarist mode. He's vulnerable, tinged with self-reckoning, and maybe even a little too self-aware. The beat feels skeletal. It's like it's making room for the memories to breathe. It's a song that just feels like paging through an old journal, but kind of in reverse. It's like telling the story of this breakup in reverse, and then like all the reckoning of the heartbreak, the mistakes he made, the thing that went right, the thing that went wrong, just all put together. It's just fantastic. I love it. I just love it so much.
Searching through the sheets in bed while the sun seeps. Right through your eyes, I see.
So, Raspberry Kisses was my favorite song on my first listen through of the album. It's just like that sugar rush of flirtation, but it has a slightly bitter aftertaste, which is not necessarily a bad thing here. The production is just fantastic. It's all like you know, those shimmering keys, the boom bap swing, almost like an early Dilla loop, but like if you put it through a kaleidoscope, if that makes sense. The vocals are like the light, almost tossed off, but like the emotion sneaks up on you. You can hear like the light wistfulness of the infatuation, and then you can hear like the switch where the doubt starts to creep in.
The way you say you can sit a kid up on it. You got some photos on that phone, put a CC on it. Yeah, I'm from the wood, I'm a hood baby. I don't make it work, I make it good baby. Crank it, it's like I'm on 3 Jim Carrey, but I never do my baby.
I think 13 Months of Sunshine is more than just a new chapter. It's a hard pivot. There's no more pastel-colored punchlines or hyper-pop, like almost like meme-ready flexes of like the early work. Here, there's textured introspection, pan-African curiosity. The palette is just radiant. He's chasing depth rather than clout. So it's diasporic and it's proudly black.
That's music journalist Akenna O4 talking about 13 Months of Sunshine, the latest album by rapper Aminé. It's out now. The WNBA is back and picked up right where it left off. Indiana's Caitlin Clark notched a triple-double Saturday as the Fever-topped rival Angel Reese's Chicago Sky. The two then-rookies powered a sensational 2024 for the league, which saw record attendance and viewership and a nail-biting championship series. So what comes next? To answer that, we called up Elle Duncan, who covers the WNBA for ESPN. I started the conversation asking how the league keeps pace with that banner 2024 year.
I mean, there's so much momentum because, of course, of the phenomenal freshman class from last year, the rookies who really were responsible for transcendent change. I mean, the W had been trending upwards for years, but they just, it was like a nitro pack on the back of the league. And now we have Paige Beckers sort of leading this next rookie class and what she's going to be able to do in Dallas. So I think, you know, we're on the precipice of huge momentum and change. This is kind of I keep joking that this year is like smoke them if you got them, because with this being the final year of the CBA, we're going to just see so much change next year, not only based on the CBA, hopefully if they can ratify a deal and there's no work stoppage, but also because I think it's something like, you guys, 90% of the league is under the final year of their contract in preparation for the CBA, meaning we don't know what any of these teams could look like next year. We could see a ton of shifting and moving. So this is going to be, I think, going to go down as one of the most impactful seasons that we've seen across any of the major sports.
Do you feel like the Caitlin Clarks, the Angel Reese's, do you feel like they feel this pressure on their shoulders of, it's not just a league, but it's so much of the emotions and aspirations put on top of it? Do you feel like that's something that weighs them down? Or do you feel like they're like, we're superstars, this is not a problem for us?
Yeah, no, I don't. I think they absolutely feel the pressure, but I do not think that it is an albatross. I mean, you got to understand too, right, guys? Like, when we think about the final year of Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark's season in college, Caitlin Clark and South Carolina, Iowa and South Carolina, 19 million people watched that national championship. I mean, 11 million people watched the Final Four before it. 9 million people watched Angel Reese versus Caitlin Clark in the Elite Eight. Like, they have had this load on them. And the way that Caitlin Clark carried that responsibility while still being a huge role model, while still being a student, still being a great teammate, I think that this generation is just built different. And that is evident by the fact that they are balancing not only trying to be great on the court, but also being brands.
Last big picture question. There was an interesting quote from the owner of the Washington Spirit, the women's soccer team here in D.C., Michelle Kang, who's saying women's sports is not a charity, trying to make the case to continue narrowing that gap between women's leagues and longer established men's pro sports. In that context, do you think at this point, even with all the momentum we've seen the last few years, the WNBA needs to keep making this case for itself in that kind of way?
I understand why there's some skepticism, it sounds like, with what she's saying, because I do think there are still people who are in wait and see mode. And candidly, I have people all the time that ask me, like, do you think it's like really worth a real investment? Like, do you really think that, do you just think it's Caitlin Clark? And I have to explain to them that we spend a lot of time talking about women's basketball because they have these transcendent stars, but I work at ESPN. We are seeing every women's sport over index. We are seeing softball, volleyball, gymnastics. They are all hitting record numbers across the board. So I think that the old style was to depend and ask sales and marketing people to have courage. It was like, we don't have a ton of data. It was always appealing to the morality. It's the right thing to do. You know, you've got daughters, you should invest, right?
Yeah.
Now we're dealing with an entirely new landscape, which is, we've got data. We have the white whale that every sales and advertising is chasing, which is a young demo, 18 to 34 are all in. Like, this is not an accident. This is part of implementation of things that have been happening for a long time, planting seeds, platforming. Like, that's happened, but certainly we have seen, as I said before, it take off and go to another stratosphere based on some of these huge names that are surrounding the sports. But that's honestly how it's been for so long, is just trying to get people to do the right thing based on gender equality, as opposed to it being great business-minded decision. And now we have the data that proves that it's just prudent business to be investing in women.
That is Elle Duncan, who covers the WNBA for ESPN, also hosts the podcast, The Elle Duncan Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Welcome to the Newsminer Sportscast. I'm Caleb Jones. Kyle Bailey, a former Lathrop High School basketball standout, has taken the next step in his professional coaching career, earning a promotion to be the head coach of the Shibuya Sunrockers, a professional basketball team based in Japan. While his profession has taken him far from where his basketball journey began in Fairbanks, Bailey still looks back to his starting point in the interior as an impactful time on his development.
Living in Alaska is difficult. And, you know, we are already in a very tough situation as far as exposure. And especially when I grew up, we didn't have anybody from Fairbanks who had, say, for example, a successful D1 career or things like that, you know. So, that challenge, and I love that. Like that always excited me. And you know, growing up in Fairbanks and being a ball boy, you know, when I was 10 years old and things like that, and being around the game, that always excited me, just to always want to see how good I could do with the opportunity.
Bailey's journey began with his dominant performances for the Lathrop Malamutes, which earned him an opportunity to play NCAA Division I basketball at Santa Clara University. There, he continued to shine, finishing his collegiate career with an All-West Coast Conference first-team selection. Following college, Bailey had a brief stint at the highest levels of American basketball, including time with the San Antonio Spurs and the Florida Flame of the NBA Development League, now known as the NBA G League. However, his most impactful playing years came overseas in Germany, where he built a 7-year career from 2005 to 2012. He was named the Bundesliga North MVP in 2007, highlighting him as one of the top players in one of Europe's premier leagues. After retiring as a player, Bailey transitioned into coaching, a move that would land him in Japan. He began as assistant coach with the Shibuya Sunrockers, holding that position for 5 seasons before moving to the Gunma Crane Thunders in the same capacity. When a head coaching vacancy opened with the Sunrockers, Bailey was tapped to step in. He led the team over the final 8 games of the season this year and has since been confirmed to continue in the role moving forward. The switch to coaching felt like a natural progression for Bailey, who primarily played as a guard, a position that often serves as an on-court extension of the coaching staff.
Well, yeah, I always, as a player, paid attention, and, playing the point guard in the guard position, you're basically a coach on the court already. And so I was always paying attention to strategy or, certain pick and roll coverages or the way the other team is playing. So I was always thinking like a coach already. And so it was just kind of a natural progression. And, I do love coaching, and I had that in mind the whole time.
Bailey now looks to lead the Sunrockers into the future. He has a lifetime of experience in the game, ranging from success at the high school up into the professional ranks. Here's what he had to say about the philosophy he has picked up along the way and plans to use guiding the franchise forward.
Yeah, most importantly, especially from my time at the Spurs, I realized the value of simplicity and then also being a team. And, you know, it's easy, especially nowadays, it's easy for things to become very individual. But the importance of being a team and being able to rely on your teammates and showing up for your teammates is just so important.
Bailey's main point of emphasis in building the team is on cohesion, each player playing for one another. He'll look to build on that in his first full year in charge of the Sunrockers. For the News Minor Sportscast, Caleb Jones.
The United States and the Philippines have a very close relationship. The country is a linchpin in the U.S. Indo-Pacific strategy, but competition between the U.S. and China is putting the Philippines in a tough spot.
If we continue to do what we're doing, we're hoping that it will give us peace.
A visit to the Embassy of the Philippines on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
And that'll be tomorrow morning starting at 5 o'clock right here on KUAC. KUAC is supported by the Fairbanks Hearing and Balance Center and the Ear, Nose, and Throat Clinic, treating hearing loss and balance disorders. Information is available at fairbankshearing.com. I started telling you about a concert with Reese Jones today. It starts at 7 o'clock. It's a house concert, and more information is available at contraborealis.org and on the Contra Borealis Dancers Facebook page.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Republicans are hoping to get President Trump's big tax bill back on track with a rare Sunday committee meeting today. Last week, five House Republicans joined Democrats in voting against the domestic policy bill because of its price tag. Engineers on transit trains in New Jersey will be back at work after a tentative agreement was reached today. The strike started Friday and talks continued through the weekend. The union says the deal includes better pay than the previous offer, which they rejected. The new contract has to be ratified by the union and approved by the state transit board. And there's a reason beloved orange cats come in that color, a special gene. Scientists say they worked with cat lovers to get DNA samples from orange felines and discovered the gene is linked to the cat's sex. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. American universities have long been celebrated for being hubs of research and innovation, and that reputation helps attract top students from around the world who come to the U.S. to pursue degrees and who often stay for careers in science and engineering. But the former president of MIT says that reputation is being threatened by President Trump's actions. Now, Raphael Reif is an engineer who led the Massachusetts Institute of Technology from 2012 to 2022, and he recently wrote an article about this for Foreign Affairs titled America's Coming Brain Drain: Trump's War on Universities Could Kill U.S. Innovation. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Oh, thank you very much, Carl. Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about the current moment, I'd actually like to talk about your background and your backstory, because you're somebody this applies to, right? You came to the U.S. from Venezuela for graduate studies.
That's correct.
What drew you to the U.S.?
Well, what drew me here is the idea of being studying and then working with the best talented people in the world and in the best places where the most advanced research was going on. I just was attracted to be among the best to move the needle of scientific discovery.
Yeah. I mean, there are top universities around the world, but it feels like every October when the Nobel Prize is announced, so many awards are given to people tied to American institutions, and often people, like you said, who were born in other countries. In your article, you talk about mRNA vaccines, 3D printing, AI, all of these big innovations. What is it specifically about the U.S. higher education system that allows it to stand out in this way?
Well, it's an excellent question, and it's an important point to ponder right now with the actions that are taken by the U.S. administration. Number one is the fact that we have the best research ecosystem in the world. It's fueled by public funds, and it includes not just, of course, the university system, but academic medical centers. This is where the best and the most advanced research happens. So people get attracted. If they want to do wonderful things and amazing things, they're attracted to where the most wonderful things happen. That's one thing. The other thing is that we have a very creative and heterogeneous population from having the most talented, at least disciplined, talented, motivated students worldwide that come to America. And the third point, of course, is that we have a terrific innovative ecosystem that's fueled by the private sector. Those three are the key elements to me that makes America the best place to do all the great things that have happened in the last at least 80 years.
Yeah. We've seen a few different fronts from the Trump administration. You have seen large federal grants frozen or pulled from big institutions. You have seen a crackdown on student visas. You've seen targeting of students in the country on visas. What to you is the most concerning? What to you has the most potential long-term damage to the higher education system?
Well, all of the above. All of the above. Let's just take one at a time. If we don't have federal public funds, I mean public funds supporting research universities, if we don't have that, none of the innovations are going to happen. You mentioned earlier that some of the things that I said in the article, mRNA and quantum computing and all those terrific innovations that we have had in this country, that is the result of public funding of research in academia. If we don't have that, we are pretty much done. I mean, where are the innovations of 25 years from now? And where are they going to come from?
Can I push back, though? Because so many of these institutions, especially the ones that are doing the most innovative research, have massive, massive endowments, have incredibly high tuition. Do they need the federal funding given the resources these institutions have?
Absolutely. Look, I think let's pick that point up and then we come back. The yearly public investment in academic research is about $60 billion annually. That's the total. The annual total spending from the endowment, of all the endowments, of all the universities in the United States, all of them, is about $30 billion. And half of that money goes to financial aid. A quarter of that money goes to support academic programs and even research itself, and the rest to cover different university operations. So even if we just don't spend a penny on financial aid or anything else, even if we don't do that, we only would cover even at most half of what the public funding is doing today.
Can I ask you, though, this all didn't come in a vacuum. For years, there have been criticisms from many Republicans, from many conservatives, not just President Trump, about higher education, about free speech concerns, about the cost of it, about political agendas from leaders of higher education institutions. You have seen this. You led a major institution for a decade. Is there a point to some of the calls for reform? Do you think higher education needs to change in one way or another? And how can it make those changes in this environment?
Well, the one thing is true. I think the tendency in American universities to be more liberal in thinking is true, it's a fact, it's there. I don't know that we need to do anything to change that. I mean, people come and think and say whatever they want to say. I don't think there is an issue of concern there, basically, but of course, conservatives would like that to change. Mm-hmm. What I do think is a problem that got things a little in the wrong direction is that all of a sudden, people with one point of view don't want to hear those of the other point of view, or they cancel them, or they boycott them. And that is wrong. And that has happened in quite a few institutions. And I think that has to change. And American institutions and administrations have to figure that out. That's a point that the conservatives in Congress and the government have made. And that's accurate. That's correct. But to address that by shooting ourselves in our foot is completely crazy.
Let me ask you this. If you were giving advice to a promising engineering student in his or her early 20s from Venezuela right now, would you tell him to come to the U.S.?
I would like to think that that what we're seeing today, which is in a very early time of the U.S. administration, if enough people like me who know what we're talking about explain it as clearly as we can to those policymakers, they will stop doing what they are doing. And I'm hoping that that will happen. And I'm thanking you for paying attention to this and having people like me on your show. But if things continue this way 3 years from now and the whole system has been dismantled, how could I recommend someone to come here?
That is L. Raphael Reif, President Emeritus and former Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you for having me.
There's a saying that two heads are better than one, and in our weekly movie segment, All Things Considered host Elsa Chang takes a look at how that adage is particularly true when it comes to certain combinations of filmmakers and actors.
All right, one of the buzziest studio releases of the year so far has been the supernatural horror film Sinners.
I don't believe in magic. Ghosts, demons. Just power.
The critical and financial hit marks the fifth collaboration between actor Michael B. Jordan and director Ryan Coogler, going back all the way to Coogler's 2013 debut, Fruitvale Station. And it got us thinking about other notable director-actor partnerships. Indeed, some of our greatest filmmakers and actors are inseparable in our minds, known best for the incredible work that they have produced together. Like, think Scorsese and De Niro.
You're talking to me? Then who the hell else are you talking to? Talking to me?
Or Spike Lee and Denzel Washington.
We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us.
To talk about more great collaborations between directors and actors, I'm joined by NPR film critic Bob Mondello and Aisha Harris, co-host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Hey to both of you.
Hey, good to be here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, Bob, I want to start with you because, you know, we mentioned a couple notable director-actor pairings there. What are some of your favorite cinematic power couples, so to speak?
Well, as the eldest among us, let me play historian for a second and do some early pairings. There's the silent film great D.W. Griffith, who directed Lillian Gish in 14 features and made her the first lady of American film.
Wait a minute, you're not that old.
I was not there at the time. director John Ford and John Wayne. Wayne was a B-movie actor before Ford hired him for Stagecoach, and that made him a named star.
So you're the notorious Ringo Kid.
My friends just call me Ringo. Nickname I had as a kid.
They paired up again for The Searchers, the war movie They Were Expendable, and about a dozen other films. John Huston and Humphrey Bogart were inseparable for a bit. Bogie was already established. He'd made about three dozen films,
wow.
But he wasn't a star. And Huston was directing his first film ever called The Maltese Falcon. The rest is history.
What is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Huh?
Aisha, what about you? What are some standout teams?
Well, I am not that old either.
Give us some color films, please.
Okay, color films. Still old. I love the collaborations between Judy Garland and Vincent Minnelli. They made several movies together, starting with Meet Me St. Louis in 1944. And they actually met and fell in love and eventually married after that movie.
Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell. Zing, zing, zing went my heartstrings from the moment I saw him, I fell.
And if we're going to go more recent and more present, Tarantino and Samuel L. Jackson, they've made six movies together. Of course, Bong Joon-ho and Song Kang-ho, who have made four movies together so far, most recently Parasite.
Yeah. And what do you guys think is key to these relationships? Like, why do they seem to catch lightning in a bottle whenever they work together? What do you think, Aisha?
Well, I mean, I think when it comes to a team up like Bong Joon-ho and Song Kang-ho, what I love about Bong's films is that no matter how dark or bleak they can get, and they do get very dark and very bleak, they tend to have this very offbeat, quirky sensibility. There's always some humor thrown in there. I think Song is able to embody both of those qualities of like the fun and the dark and the slapstick occasionally handily in those roles when he's playing with that director.
Well, Bob, what else do you see in these actor-director collabs that is hard to replicate with just any pairing of a director and an actor?
Well, the example that I always keep coming back to is Pedro Almodovar has worked with lots of people, obviously, and Antonio Banderas has worked with lots of people, but when Pedro Almodovar discovered Antonio Banderas, he was 22, and he molded and shaped him in those first few pictures, The Woman on the Verge of, of a Nervous Breakdown, Law of Desire, Matador, those movies. And I think he saw in Banderas something that other people didn't see. When American studios and directors looked at Antonio Banderas, they saw Zorro. And that is not what that man is all about. They saw Puss in Boots. So, I mean, I think it's clear that there is something tight between those guys, which is not there when he works with other people.
That said, I mean, there are so many ways to create magic, right? Not just the right team, because I would think for the sake of creativity and versatility and play, you would want an actor to work with multiple directors and a director to switch it up with their lead stars. Like Aisha, wouldn't it be cool to see Ryan Coogler work with, say, I don't know, Timothée Chalamet, or see Michael B. Jordan in a Paul Thomas Anderson movie? Like, what do you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, I personally would love to see Michael B. Jordan work with Steven Soderbergh. I think if he was doing some sort of like heist film or something that requires like a whole team and there's an ensemble, like I think seeing Jordan work with someone like that would be so fascinating. But the thing is like Michael B. Jordan so far, his best collaborations have been with Ryan Coogler. And I can't fault him for wanting to keep going back to that well, because no one else has been able to figure out how to make Michael B. Jordan the star that he is.
Okay, so we can understand why Michael B. Jordan would keep going back to that well of Coogler, but we don't want that well to become a rut. So besides the fantasy of Michael B. Jordan and maybe a Soderbergh pairing, who else do you wish would work together more? Like the one or two collabs that should have been or would be the beginning of a beautiful friendship if they just gave romance a chance? Bob, what do you think?
Okay, well, this is my fantasy, okay?
Yeah.
Purely my fantasy.
I love your fantasy.
I want to see Daniel Craig working with Alfred Hitchcock.
One's dead.
I think that would be really sublime, okay? Because I think he's established in the Glass Onion movies that he would be a fun person in that kind of film. And I think that would be sensational. I think Hitchcock could bring out all kinds of interesting things in Daniel Craig. So I'm hoping to see that in the future.
Beyond the grave. Aisha.
Bob, I admire that fantasy, that leap of faith that somehow we'll figure out how to bring Hitchcock back. I'll stay more realistic here. I would love to see Greta Gerwig work with Saoirse Ronan again. They've already done Lady Bird and Little Women together. That pairing has been very, very magical. And then finally, I would say Barry Jenkins and Brian Tyree Henry, who collaborated on If Beale Street Could Talk.
I just got out of Slammer, baby. 2 years.
He has this one standout scene in that film where he's playing someone who was in prison for a while, and he comes out, and now he's like, he's describing what that does to a person, and everything about it is just like, I encourage people to go seek that movie out if they haven't already. It kind of flew under the radar compared to Moonlight, Barry Jenkins' previous movie,
totally.
But like, he is so good, and I would love to see what else they would do together with Jenkins directing him.
That is NPR's Bob Mondello and Aisha Harris. Another great collab, I might say. Thank you to both of you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For Sunday, that's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. Thank you for listening. We will talk to you again soon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. And from Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank, part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. This is NPR.
And this is KUAC-FM Fairbanks, a listener-supported service of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. We are at 89.9 on your listening dial. Here in the Middle Tanana Valley, well, that would be Fairbanks and North Pole, the air quality is good. Sunset will happen around 11:21 p.m. this evening for a total.
Lots of things.